Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom. In an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace, I'm your host, Care Hallenbeck. We are all inspired by those individuals who have physical impairments and rise above the crowd to make a way out of no way. But what about those of us who have scars on the inside? These words written by today's guest. Charles Thomas Jr. is the author of the book Scars, Exile, and Vindication, My Life as an Experiment, newly published by Tate Publishing. It tells the autobiographical story of a young man born and raised in Flint, Michigan, whose journey led him from devastation to inspiration. In his words, scars remind us that the past is real and give us motivation to move forward into the future with an attitude of optimism and a promise of better days to come. Charles, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Care.
Now, first of all, when I think of Flint, Michigan, I still think of the 1989 film Roger and Me by Michael Moore. It detailed the economic and psychic devastation of the city due to the closure of several auto plants in the region. And I recall specifically the use of the Beach Boys song Wouldn't It Be Nice as a very heart-wrenching and tragic image. Can you tell us some of your experiences of growing up in Flint?
Yeah, I can. Well, first of all, I'd like to say again, thanks for having me on the show. And coming from Flint, Michigan, I think it was an absolutely terrific upbringing because it allows people early on to understand, you know, the negative things in life and how you need to have resilience, perseverance, desire, dedication to move forward. Mm. Growing up in a city like Flint, you learn the importance of character, integrity, values, family, because throughout life things happen, and if you don't have that type of background, it's very hard to overcome a lot of the negative situations that happen in a person's life. I mean, it could be a small mountain to some and a huge mountain to others, but either way, growing up like that teaches you a certain level of understanding of how to deal with situations, because, I mean, in a city like that, you have children who experience things that many people don't experience their entire lives.
Right.
The first time, and I can't really speak on other people's story because I don't really know, but I know from my perspective, the first time that I was ever even, you know, had a death experience was when I was 7 years old, and one of my best friends at the time was killed. He was shot in the neck, and he passed away in his mother's arms. So even at that age, not that the person who did it, because he was also young, he was about 9, I would imagine.
Wow.
I don't think there was any malice or malicious intent involved with that situation. It was just more of a, you know, a young kid saw a gun underneath the chair. People were playing, and, you know, he was shot and killed. But it goes to show that in a city like that, where how the parents have to protect their children so much so that you have a loaded weapon somewhere where a child could reach it. I mean, I remember this like it was yesterday. You know, as a 7-year-old, I walk up to a casket and put in a football and, you know, say goodbye, and you don't really understand why something like that would happen to a young kid. And fortunately for me, though, I had, you know, my mom and my dad who were very strong-willed and taught me, you know, sometimes things happen and you just have to understand that God does what he does for a reason and the universe is unfolding as it should.
Yeah.
And you have to, it's okay to question God, but you also can never stop trusting in him. And my mom just repeated that to me day before yesterday, as a matter of fact, because, you know, she always says God can handle our questions. We just have to be ready for his answers. You know, and in a city like Flint, me and my sister were talking earlier today, too, and it's kind of crazy stories. When I was 12, we're sitting in a line at Taco Bell, me and my dad and my sister, and you hear, again, the first time I saw, you know, saw someone get shot in person, was like, we're sitting in a line at Taco Bell, and you hear arguments, gunshots, screams, then all of a sudden you just hear silence. And the crazier part about that is we continued to order our food. My dad was like, yeah, so we want a couple chalupas, soft tacos, and some cinnamon twist.
Goodness.
So at that age, I mean, you get so desensitized to negativity and violence that, you know, by the time you're 14, 15 years old, and for some people, it's even younger than that. Like,
yeah.
Negativity, it still bothers you, but it doesn't. Your heart, I don't want to say your heart becomes hardened, but you just, it's no big deal. Like, I mean, if you're sitting at a bowling alley or at a, you know, some type of casual event and a fight breaks out, if that altercation is not within arm's reach of you, you don't even get up. It's like, well, they're not bothering me, so I'm not really too worried about what's going to happen here. And it's kind of interesting to see how that translates into life in general, because, I mean, we always talk about, me and my friends that are from there, if you make it out of a place like Flint, Detroit, Saginaw, Chicago, different parts of California, you know,
right.
Compton, Watts, South Central, if you make it out of those type of places, everything else is easy. You don't really get too high on the highs and too low with the lows. You kind of understand to stay in your lane but also look left and right, just so you do what you do and stay out of the way so that you can succeed and excel in whatever it is, whatever your chosen activity is. So it's a pretty interesting environment to grow up in and watch to see how things take
place.
Well,
yes, and you know, Charles, I mean, people make, you know, common reference to things like this place being a war zone or that place
right.
being a war zone, but in this situation, it's really rather literal, and what you're sharing now demonstrates, you know, this sort of survival, you know, like this is something you survived.
Right.
As your childhood, and also that, you know, we only know the reality that we know.
Right.
So if that's all you knew, you know, and that's the experience, then yeah, you know, then you keep ordering your, you know, the food at the restaurant. But, you know, we're not speaking about making lemons, you know, to lemonade here.
Right.
This is deep adversity, and, you know, were there others around you who were another kind of example? How did you, when you say about God that, yeah, you know, this is really bad, but you still have to believe in him,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are plenty of folks who coming home after experience of war or something very tragic can go either way and either cling more tightly to their spirituality or completely throw it off.
Okay.
You know, so were there others, I mean, you mentioned your parents,
mm-hmm.
Where did these values come from then?
You know, I would have to say absolutely it came from my mom and my dad, aunts, uncles, close family, friends, because a lot of times, and I think I'm a different breed when it comes to growing up in a city like Flint, because my parents sacrificed significantly to send me to private schools.
All right.
So even though I went to private schools, but the stuff that I wanted to do, I wanted to play basketball, and the place you learned, you had to go to the rougher areas and play with the guys if you wanted to be good at a sport. So for me, those values come from watching my mom and watching my dad. And, you know, he was working two jobs. And even though in high school our, you know, relationship was rocky or whatever, I could always look and be like, hey, you know, he's working two jobs. My mom is working crazy hours. My aunts and uncles are doing everything that they can to, you know, be in working class families to make sure that all of us survive. So you get those values of hard work, dedication, persistence, you know, you never take no for an answer if you think that there's a better way. You get those type of values, I mean, in my particular case, from home, and you see it from your friends too who have different situations, but, you know, regardless of the circumstances, they continue to walk forward.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, when I look back on those experiences, I think that I 100% attribute the successes that I've had in life so far to everything that I learned at home from my parents and, again, family, aunts and uncles. Because a lot of times they would always say, they would unapologetically challenge me to continue on, even if you wanted to stop, or because Flint is a place that you are not by any means immune to the trials and tribulations that go on there. You can go to the best private school, you could go to the worst inner city school that there is, but there is that option where you're walking straight, but you can still be consumed by the streets. And it happens to a lot of people, not necessarily because they're bad kids or they want to be reckless and believe in anarchy or anything like that. It's more just a, it's just the nature of the game sometimes.
Yeah.
Idle mind syndrome kicks in. You know, they shut down General Motors plants. They shut down community centers, boxing rings, places where kids can go and play basketball. So then all of a sudden, expectations are low. They tell you that high school is the degree to have. And, I mean, that's not the case. Like, we can't survive as a race, particularly young black men, because, you know, sometimes we're deemed inherently dangerous as it is.
Yeah.
So we can't allow ourselves to be in a position where we have these low expectations set on us, and then we say, oh, okay, you know, it's cool if I get a high school diploma. That's what the world expects. That's not how it can be. But in places like Flint, again, Detroit, Chicago, you get that, and you have to have the internal motivation to carry on and continue to walk and, you know, seek wise counsel, like the Bible says, from people who've been there, done that, bought the T-shirt type deal.
Right.
Because you can't, particularly at a young age, not even now, all of our experiences aren't all-encompassing, so it's impossible for any of us to know the answer and to know how to proceed on our own. We have to reach out to others to kind of give guidance and help us along the way. Unfortunately for me, I think that's how I stayed, you know, on the straight and narrow while I was, you know, in high school.
Yeah. Now, Charles, did going to private school set you apart somehow from your peers? Was that an issue?
Yeah, it kind of did, you know, and I look back on it, and I wasn't a sad kid. I was very free-spirited. I had fun. I always wanted to learn, but I was the private school kid. I was the one. I just happened to know how to play basketball pretty well also, you know. And I also would go to the rougher areas to play basketball. So inside of my school, my parents worked extremely hard so that we didn't have, me and my younger sister, we didn't have to want for anything. So to the external world, like, my parents were these people who making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, when the fact of the matter was that wasn't true.
Right.
But my mom and dad always taught, like, you don't talk about what's going on. You don't talk about your accomplishments. You deal with them when they're done. When once they're done, you check that box, you move on to the next one.
Right.
So from a private school perspective, when I would go to different gyms or to different parks, playgrounds, whatever, I would get, oh, yeah, that's the boy that goes to private school. He thinks he's better than us, or he's not as good as we are in basketball. So it was kind of that, well, now I have to prove to you I'm probably better than you are at this sport, and I'm going to work hard. I'm not going to necessarily argue with you and, you know, try to defend myself. Like an author I read, Brian Tracy, always says, you know, never complain, never explain, resist the temptation to make excuses or defend yourself.
Right.
So even at a young age, I was that kid. I was like, well, I can't necessarily change your perception of me and what's going on because I go to private school. All I can do is, you know, walk this path, and ultimately you're either going to understand, you know, our humanity is what connects us, and just because I go to a private school doesn't necessarily mean I'm not as good as you in a particular sport, or
right,
I look down on you because, you know, my parents are struggling to keep, you know, to keep me in a private school, because really and truly, I begged my mom to send me to a public school. She wasn't having it. So because I thought, well, yeah, if I go to public school, I'll get the respect and, you know, the different accolades that, you know, my peers are getting from playing basketball, football,
right,
track,
right,
whatever, you know, I'll go there. But parents, you know, having infinite wisdom like they do, she knew that if she sent me to a public school, I may have fallen off track.
Right.
Even though I was never really a follower, but sometimes when you have those type of pressures as a child, you may succumb to those pressures. So in my mom and my dad's mind is, we're going to keep you in this private school because we want you to go to a very strong college, and, you know, consequently, I end up going to consequently, I end up going to the University of Notre Dame, which I don't think, you know, even looking back on it, had I went to a public school, not disparaging any public schools, but I think the situation that I was in set me in a pretty good position to move forward in a positive manner.
And it's interesting. Was it ever a thought, sort of in the background, for your parents and family to put that effort into leaving Flint?
You know, it's a lot of stuff that, you know, my mom and my dad and aunts and uncles who are still there probably considered.
Yeah.
But, you know, they came from even worse situations growing up in Mississippi and Arkansas than we did. So when you consider the two places, Flint wasn't so bad. And Flint is much worse now than it is when they went. you know, it was always pretty rough, but when I got in high school, that's when things start being a lot worse in the city because of the, I guess they call it the brain drain, and how they were shutting down different plants and everything.
Yeah.
So, they probably discussed it, but again, me being a kid, they wouldn't have discussed it with me anyway. You know, when I was in, you know, it's certain things that I'm finding out now that my parents did to make sure I stayed in college that still, it baffles me that, you know, somebody would sacrifice so much for a kid, and I'm eternally grateful for stuff like that, because they could, if, you know, had they not did what they did, I could have easily fallen off the track. I mean, I have several friends in jail or dead now simply because, you know, they went the wrong direction.
Well, I tell you, Charles, that makes what makes such a difference so often is parental dedication. But still, let's revisit now. You've got a childhood where folks are, you know, you're watching them get shot
mm-hmm.
around you. I've heard you share, you know, even stepping over the deceased.
Right.
You're going to school or even to Notre Dame. But how did that affect you? What are you carrying inside? What were some of the effects of these experiences?
You know, a lot of it is, you know, you have a certain level of fear that goes on, not afraid of another person, but it's just like you don't want to fail because so many people have sacrificed for you, but you have that always in the back of your mind, like, well, it's okay if I don't do so well. They don't expect me to do well, you know?
Yeah.
Because the environment or the world will tell you that people from Flint, they're victims of the circumstance. You're going to go to jail before either the graveyard or prison before the age of 25. So that type of stuff is, you know, deep down inside, it's a constant motivation to do better, to, you know, pursue excellence as a demonstration of human potential. But sometimes the desire to do well gets trumped by looking back and like, man, like, you're not even supposed to be here, so the fact that you made it here is all right, so you can kind of rest on your laurels type deal.
Yeah.
But it doesn't allow, I personally don't allow myself to do that simply because I've understood that complacency is an attitude far more dangerous than rage. So, I mean, just sitting there and not doing anything, you can just as easily go to prison. So the scars that you see from growing up, and like I mentioned, referenced in the book, the domestic violence, the emotional abuse, the verbal abuse, that type of stuff makes a kid want to, you know, you always seek the validation of, you know, adults, authority figures. You kind of want that pat on the back sometimes.
Yeah, of course.
You know, even as an adult, it's just like you want somebody to tell you, good job, because you sometimes as a kid, you might not have necessarily gotten it from the people who you wanted to get it from.
Yeah, or supposed to get it from.
Yeah, or, you know, we're supposed to get it from. So
right.
those are the internal scars that you have, that you harbor on. I mean, like I said, my dad and I's relationship was very rocky in high school, and I'm going to preface this conversation because now we're fine. You know, me writing the book was very therapeutic and cathartic for me, and that was my way of releasing everything that what I perceived to be negative or how he may have perceived it. So, you know, in high school, our relationship was very rocky sometimes because I felt that he didn't, you know, maybe he didn't care and I didn't understand why, and I wanted you to come to basketball games. I wanted these certain things to happen. And, you know, I look back on it, I understand, you know, he had to provide because now I'm in a similar situation, you know, having a five-year-old where sometimes you do have to work late and you might not necessarily be able to make it back to an event. It's not because you don't want to, but you do have to. You have a choice. You got to keep the lights on, right?
Yeah. I know, but isn't it amazing how no matter what the situation, it's those simple things that children seek. You know, there's probably a little kid standing in the rubble of Gaza just wanting to play ball.
Right. Yeah, and
no matter what's going on around them.
Yeah, when you talk about the simple things, I've really learned at this point to appreciate the simple things. The, hey, good job today. Hey, I appreciate what you did. You know, show that gratitude because one of the deepest desires in human nature is the desire to be appreciated, and you know, or to have someone have a level of gratitude for, you know, just showing up and being there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's the type of the scars on the inside that people, and it's just not me, like my story isn't unique in the fact that I was raised in the jungle by gorillas and they taught me how to read. My story is, I think, unique in the fact that what I talk about happens to everybody, but people shy away from it because they feel that as if they have to go through these struggles and trials and tribulations alone, and that's not the case at all. You know, so internally, now I'm a lot better than what I used to be because I had lost my way for a while in graduate school. And, you know, after Akil was killed when I was 20, when we buried him on my 26th birthday. So, you know, when you have situations like that, and he was killed in Flint too, you have those scars on the inside. It's like when people are there and then they walk away or they're taken away for whatever reason, and you can't necessarily understand why what happened.
Well, but it sounds natural that, you know, the conflict would continue because in some ways it's almost like two distinct lives still kind of colliding. You know, the one still going on in Flint, but also the one that you're aspiring into, that they seem to keep, you know, revisiting each other. So in a culture, and I'm sure you can relate to this, of material achievement and awards, mm-hmm. As we're accustomed to, these scars. Let's talk about, you know, you've written such a wonderful book on this.
Thank you.
Let's talk about failures and scars. What do they hold for us?
Well, and this is just my personal belief, and I don't speak for the masses, but I think you learn so much from your failures and scars. So take, for example, like I would want my dad to come to a basketball game, for example. So now you've learned from that type of stuff. So now when, you know, Masani goes to gymnastics, I'll go. Like, even if I don't feel like going, if I'm at home, I make it a point to make it happen because you learn through going to church, and whatever generational curses that happened previously, they don't have to carry on. They can stop with whomever chooses to stop them. And in my world, like, I choose to stop any negativity that I saw growing up, be that arguments over finances or what should be done, how it should be done, when we should do it, that type of stuff. And not that my household is perfect at all, but I don't want to have to deal with the same stuff that, you know, me and my sister saw growing up. So I take 100% responsibility for not arguing in front of a child, you know, making sure we work extremely hard so that the family can not only survive but thrive in an economy where everybody just thankful to have a job. And I don't, you know, that again, that's a low expectation for me, so I don't want to, you know, you can't just meet that and think that that's acceptable. And the failures in and of itself, that's how people learn. You know, I listen to music, I read all the time, and Jay-Z is quoted as saying, even in defeat there's a valuable lesson learned, so it evens it up for me. And I 100% believe that the successes are fine, but you really and truly have to reevaluate, go through some type of self-reflection or self-introspection when you fail at something.
Mm. Is there something that pops out in terms of a failure or something you ran into you could elaborate on a little as a kind of, you know, anecdotal example?
Yeah, you know, for failures for me this book is a prime example.
This book?
Not that it's published now, but there were so many failures going through. I was rejected by probably 35 to 40 publishers.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, did it take long to write the book?
You know, Kara, it took me probably about writing time, probably 6-7 months to write. So, no, I would say it didn't take that long. And I actually finished this book back in 2009. But you talk about so many failures. I sent it to publisher after publisher after publisher, and I kept getting nope, 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 you're nobody, nope, 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 try again.
Wow.
And it was more of a, and I think it was God was closing doors because I don't think the book ended well. It ended on a very bad and sour note. And then when I was over in Afghanistan, I changed the ending, and when I came back, it ended on a more of a prophetic note, and this is what I plan to do moving forward. And it was very an easy transition into finding a publisher once I accepted that I needed to learn from the failures and why they weren't accepting it. And even, you know, prior to that, failures such as, you know, I look back to playing sports, you know, like in high school, I was in a geometry class and I wasn't doing so well, like not by my standards, and I wanted to quit. But it's like, and I actually did withdraw from class, and my mom was having none of it. She flipped out. She told my counselor, my basketball coaches, you know, my soccer coach, you're never dropping the class. You will never give up type deal. So the failures right there allow you to understand that you have to carry on and you can't give up. And more failures such as not necessarily scoring as high as I wanted to on some standardized test to get into graduate school, or not being able to play basketball, you know, a lot, have a lot of minutes while I was at college. So to me, those type of things are failures. They're not, you know, you didn't fail in such a way that you ended up dying or going to prison or something like that. But we each have our own different mountains that we climb where we look at things, but we all have to learn to take them as a learning experience.
Right. And that your book, as you say, ends on a more prophetic note, I guess, is that sort of finding the, let's say, the hope from the failures, or being able to tease out hope, because in some way, what else was driving you?
Well, you know, it does end in a prophetic manner now, but I really lost my way again when Akil was killed in 2006. I felt like I lost a brother. I didn't understand, like, why such a thing would happen. And when I say I lost my way, this is more, I'm in graduate school. I'm getting straight A's, but I'm drinking every day.
Right.
You know, so you're talking, I'm not just one drink. I'm going to class, you know, after five or six shots of vodka or tequila or whatever, and I'm still getting straight A's in finance classes. I'm writing papers. I'll get them back. You know, the teacher will, professor will write something like, oh, this is very profound and insightful. And it would be funny because I would read it like, I don't even remember writing this.
Huh.
You know, so I was on this downward spiral of negativity and not understanding, like, how to pull myself out of it. But the fact of the matter is, I think with the grounding at a place, growing up in Flint, and that survival instinct and having, and I couldn't talk to anybody about it because I felt like, well, I can't tell anybody what's going on here because they'll think I'm crazy, or, you know, I'm just another one of these guys that just do what they want to do and, you know, nothing positive will happen. So it was, I didn't really feel like I could talk to anyone about it. So I carried on and I kept pushing and pushing, and until one day I went to, you know, dinner with a family friend, and his mom had a sip of one of the drinks, which I thought was extremely watered down, and she was like, really? And she was like, this thing is full of alcohol. You might have a problem. And she said it jokingly.
Yeah.
But it kind of triggered in my mind of an idea of, I need to go on this journey of self-introspection and self-reflection, because, you know, even Socrates, he says, a life unexamined is not worth living.
That's right.
So I go through this whole process of, well, when I succeeded, why did I succeed? When I failed, why did I fail? Why am I, you know, how am I doing well externally, but internally I'm dying and killing myself slowly for what reasons?
Right.
You know, so I would go to, you know, I would go to church and listen to the preachers talk, and, you know, sometimes it was okay, but other times it was like, yeah, whatever, they don't really understand what's going on in my world. So those type of issues where I started to understand what I needed to do in order to get better, we just look at things differently and tell myself there is a better way. I don't have to allow these scars to hold me back, because there, I mean, even now there's still a void there. Like, there's not a day goes by that I don't think about, you know, my brother that I lost.
Right.
You know, but you have those situations where you have to be like, okay, well, I'll move on, and not that you forget, but you have to move on so that you can potentially help other people who've dealt with certain situations, be that death or significant adversity, you know, through playing sports or loss of a friend or people telling you what you can't do. Because I've even had, you know, you talk about going back to, you know, high school, people telling you, well, you know, you're too little, you're not smart enough, you won't go to a big time school, you won't play basketball at a Division I university. When that comes from your peers, it hurts even worse.
Mm.
So those are the scars that I think many of us, or when it comes from an adult that you hold in high esteem, and they tell you something that completely knocks you off balance and rots your confidence, those are the type of scars that I think many people hold on the inside that prevents them from reaching their goals, because they still have these voices in the back of their mind telling them that they're not smart enough, they're not fast enough, they're not strong enough, they're not big enough, when in actuality, they really and truly are good enough to do whatever it is that they ultimately set out to do.
Thank you so much, Charles. That's so beautifully said. And we're about halfway through the program. We're just going to take a short break. Stay on the line. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. When we return from the break, we'll continue our conversation with Charles Thomas, Jr., author of Scars, Exile, and Vindication. Let's take a couple of minutes now with a musical break. Stay with us.
I was waiting for so long for a miracle to come. Everyone told me to be strong, and don't shed a tear. Through the darkness and good times, I knew I'd make it through. And the world thought I had it all, but I was waiting for you.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're speaking with Charles Thomas, Jr., author of Scars, Exile, and Vindication, about how his life evolved from devastation to inspiration, and that was a little of Celine Dion. I always loved that song, Let the Rain Come Down and Wash Away Our Tears.
I agree.
And yes, a new day has come. But you know what? As we were discussing in the last half hour, sometimes a new day comes. We may not necessarily be prepared for it. We were just discussing Charles's experience of childhood in Flint, Michigan. Some very profound experiences of fear, of pain, of violence. Things that that may be routine in some kids' lives growing up, and emerging as he has as the author of this wonderful book, and we were discussing graduate studies there. In this part of the program, I'd like to explore a little more of the spiritual aspect of your journey, if you can, because the discussion of scars and the scars that remain with us brings to mind to me you know, the Doubting Thomas story in Scripture, where Jesus returns after his resurrection to, and,
right.
and lets us, you know, he has his scars,
mm-hmm.
and these define him. Perhaps they don't trouble him anymore, but they define him.
Right.
I remember writing an article about the scar I have after a C-section.
Mm-hmm.
and, you know, how it was so important to the doctors to make it invisible or to make it try to go away. And it made me wonder, well, I have this also, you know, in the afterlife. It defines me. I don't
right.
necessarily want to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about the internal scars as well, that we, many of us, most of us, have on one level or another.
Right.
And for you, I mean, this child who grew up and became the man I'm talking to now, how did you find your way out? Are you a man of faith?
I am. It's the only thing that actually sustains me, having a very strong faith-filled life and understanding that, you know, God does favor the faithful and, you know, and fortune favors the bold. He won't, you know, they say that God won't ever put more on you than you can handle. You know, sometimes I think...
Do you believe that?
I don't, but I think that he knows that those situations allow you to become better in the future. Sometimes we go through situations where the Murphy's Law, everything that can go wrong will go wrong no matter what you try to do. And sometimes, you know, people can't handle those things, and sometimes a lot of people crumble under that pressure.
Yeah.
And I think for me, I feel like I walk a different path because I serve a higher power.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand, you know, sometimes God says we're going to put you in this situation just to see. But I also believe that if you can't handle it, there's an exit sign where he's going to pull you out of it. So I've watched my mom and my dad and aunts and uncles struggle through different things, and through it all, they've maintained a high level of faith and understanding that God's promises, like the Bible always says, are yes and amen. So I believe in, again, my faith is the only thing that keeps me moving forward when I don't necessarily know what the ending is going to be, because, I mean, none of us really know when our
right.
number is going to be called. So you have to believe, I feel like you have to believe in something, a higher power that's stronger than us, that's omniscient, omnipotent, that can carry you, because I don't even feel like I walk with God anymore. I've said, I'm on your back now. I can't, you know, you can't deal with this stuff, so just carry me through.
And is there a particular a tradition or church that you're a member of or follow?
Well, just the Christian faith. We were raised Baptist, but now out here, I go to the church I go to is a non-denominational church, you know, and they preach from the Bible, and they talk about our current pastor. He's very professorial in nature, and he teaches. You know, we're talking right now. We're going through the whole process of 2 Peter of, you know, add love to your faith and add desire to strengthen, all of that type of stuff, where you don't. Where you understand you shouldn't give up in certain situations, and how faith truly is, you know, the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things unseen.
Yeah.
You know, I was reading one of Joel Osteen's books, and I think it's called It's Your Time. And his analogy was that faith is like being in a car, and it's super foggy out, and you can only see 10 feet in front of you, but you continue to drive because you have to trust that your lights are bright enough that at the next 10 feet is going to show you the next 10 feet.
Mm.
So that's how I feel about faith. I don't necessarily know what's going to happen, but I feel as if as long as I keep walking, the headlights will keep showing me the direction. And as long as I pray and stay faithful to whatever it is that I'm trying to do and not veer too far off path, ultimately, you know, the universe conspires to help.
Mm. Thank you. Well said. Could you share a little about what the exile and vindication aspects are that are in your book?
Yeah, well, exile comes from, and you know, when I was going through a lot of the stuff, I felt like people were pushing me to the side, but that wasn't necessarily the case. The exile, I believe, was absolutely self-imposed. I would pull away from family and friends, and I wouldn't talk to anybody, and I kind of went on this island by myself because I felt like I had to solve all of the world's problems. I had to write, you know, the second version of War and Peace all in one day. I didn't feel as if I could reach out to somebody who had already been there and say, hey, what am I doing wrong here? Help me understand why I have, you know, a couple graduate degrees, but I can't get a job.
But you can't talk to anyone.
Right. What am I doing so wrong here? But I didn't reach out to anybody. So this self-exile was more of me just pulling away from the world because I thought the story ended with me. So I was like, well, you know, I have to figure out what I need to do and how I need to do it. When the fact of the matter was, the story doesn't end with me because it didn't start with me. And once I started to realize that portion of it, the vindication comes along where you stop comparing yourself, because you go through these phases where I know now that comparing yourself to somebody else is probably the worst thing that you can do, because you never know how people are dealing with their issues.
Exactly.
So for me, it was, you know, I became, you know, my own worst critic. I'm my own worst enemy. I'm my toughest competition. So the vindication part of it comes when I finally realized, again, that the story doesn't end with me because it didn't start with me, and I can reach out to other people. I don't have to walk alone. I don't have to prove to you, world, that I can go to graduate school. I can play Division I basketball. I can write a book. I can, you know, get married. I can buy a house. I can make money. I can do all of these things that you said that I couldn't do.
Hmm.
Not necessarily the I told you so syndrome, but
right.
More of, I did this because with God, with me on God's back, because he has a different plan for me to be able to reach out and tell the underdog story and talk to these kids that, you know, feel like just because they don't have a father figure at home or they're from a broken home and they go through a lot of negativity that they, for whatever reasons, can't make it. So that's where the vindication portion comes, because we're not, you know, all bad. There is some stuff about, you know, people from Flint and everywhere else. I have friends that are chefs, doctors, lawyers, nurses, but the media always sensationalizes the negative.
Of course.
And they don't talk about those of us who have come from these places. And we might not be millionaires, and by no means have we reached the ultimate destination of success in our current journeys. But the fact of the matter is, we haven't drowned because in the raging waters. We've kept swimming. We weren't. Some of us weren't consumed by the streets. And even those that were, the ones that are in, you know, prison, they can still have some level of redemption. So that's where I think the vindication comes from, you know, a young black man who's trying to do things, you know, the right way, differently, you know, walk to the beat of my own drum, but still don't feel as if I have to impress society, you know, because of material things, you know, trophies and accolades and all that type of stuff, because ultimately none of that stuff matters if you don't, you know, help your neighbor to get to where they want to be, or at least be able to sit down, have
right.
a conversation with them and let them know, hey, you're not in this thing alone. I'm with you.
And you know, Charles, that's exactly why we're here. I just want to mention what you just said, something about the media.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why we're here is because it's very difficult anywhere in the media to find any conversation on spirituality or the journey or religion
mm-hmm.
that's not somehow a fight.
Right.
And about people trying to prove each other wrong or beat each other down
mm-hmm.
or exclude each other.
Right.
And this is a dedicated place,
right.
a space for grace, as it were,
right.
For people to share. And what you said before about not being able to talk to someone, you know, sometimes when something is really severe in our life, the thought of talking to someone, kind of naming it, can make it real.
Right.
And some folks can have a very emotional reaction to that and fear that they may not be able to continue on, like there's a breakdown coming.
I agree.
Is that something that resonates?
It does. Like, again, me not talking to people was, again, 100% self-imposed, because you do feel that people will, you know, inaccurately judge you or, you know, always try to give you solutions, and then you get the whole pride factor that says, this isn't supposed to happen to me. I'm not supposed to be laid off. I'm not supposed to have $9.82 in the bank. I have multiple master's degrees, right? This type of stuff isn't supposed to happen to me. You can't reach out to someone. Well, I didn't think that you could reach out to someone and be like, look, I'm struggling. I don't understand what's going on.
Right.
Because you don't know you don't know how they're going to respond. And that, the certainty of uncertainty for most people is the scariest thing ever, when you feel that you don't know how someone's going to respond to you and if what they say to you is going to resonate so deeply that it could ruin you. Because some people say that words don't hurt, but words hurt much worse than physical breaks.
Yeah, it's true. And very often, sometimes it's all we have in terms of a memory of someone. Even
right.
a loved one is something they said
right.
that lingers with us. Now, what are you doing now? And what do you hope to do in your life, in this world, with this experience that you've had of your childhood and your education and your books coming now, and this role you're beginning to play now in community?
Yeah, ultimately, you know, right now I work as a strategy consultant for a federal government contracting firm out in Northern Virginia, and I've also started, you know, I'm in different nonprofit organizations, leadership institutes. One where we work with the homeless, and also a member of the Make-A-Wish Foundation. So for me, my ultimate objective is, you know, and it kind of sounds cliche, but to make my corner of the world a little bit better than it was when I found it.
Yeah.
So I want to have the platform to be able to go out and talk to people about tough issues, about what it's like to be a young black man in corporate America, what it's like to deal with adversity, what it means to have faith, desire, resilience, and patience, what it means to always have high moral standards, integrity, character, and have certain non-negotiable principles that no matter what they say to you, you never falter. Because a lot of times I think people get into this situation where peer pressure hits, or they feel like they need to try something new, which, you know, might not be ethical or moral to get to the next step. And that's not necessarily the case. Sometimes people just need to have someone to talk to. So for me, the book, again, was very therapeutic for me, and so now I feel like I can tell this story or talk to people about it, because I've come to grips with, you know, relationship with my dad, and, you know, how their relationship, my mom, my dad, my sister, and how we grew up together, you know, and going through different life experiences together, you know, some good, some bad. But either way, they were experiences that taught us all how to proceed in the future with a spirit of love, respect, faith, and understanding. You know, as I go out and talk to people, I hope to, you know, prove Stephen Covey's words to be true, that you always have to seek first to understand before being understood.
Yeah.
That's the type of stuff that I aspire to do. And
I think I think St. Francis said that. I think isn't that in the Francis prayer?
Seek
to understand rather to be understood.
Yeah, and it was in Stephen Covey's book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
Yeah.
Yeah, so ultimately that's what I want to do, is just to have a platform, you know, in the work world, of course, continue to climb that corporate ladder, and, you know, and I'd probably transition into academia at some point, because I feel like I'm probably better served there, you know, from a teaching and understanding and intellectual discourse standpoint.
Right. Now, does helping your corner of the world also include, you know, revisiting Flint in that context?
Absolutely, and I've been talking to some friends of mine. Within the next year, I hope to put something together that is truly meaningful, because I don't want to be one of these guys who kind of fly in and fly out, give a speech, rah-rah, see you later.
Exactly.
Like, I want to have, set up a platform where actual people are involved, because, again, there are so many people from Flint who are doing extremely well right now, PhD candidates, doctors, lawyers, chefs, professional athletes. We're all scattered across the country, but the kids at home don't necessarily see us, because when you're at home, even if you see somebody at home who is decently successful, you feel, well, they can't be that successful, they're still here in Flint, and that can't be farther from the truth.
Right.
So I would like to have, and I've been in communication with a couple of people back home to kind of have something where we can go in and have a panel discussion and, you know, assign mentors that about whatever it is to the people who have a desire or aspirations to do well, where we can actually be there for them and say, you know, we come from the same place, we understand the stuff that you're going through, particularly the athletes who are going to deal with the girls and the potentially the drugs and the fast life of how everything that comes with that. But right now it hasn't had much traction, and I won't give up on that, because I do believe it's something very important. We haven't had that at home, these real deep, very thoughtful conversations that could have an impact on somebody's life, on someone's life in the long term.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that we can, you know, pull that off at some point within the next year and make it a big deal at home so that people know that those who are from there want to go back and actually do care and they're just not paying lip service to what we want to do and actually make it happen.
Yes, yes. And Charles, do you have any direct words of love or hope for any peers right now who might be listening in Flint, Michigan?
Yeah, you know, for me, I believe that we all have to work together because we go through these processes or these life trials and tribulations where we feel like we want to give up. And I just want to tell people that, you know, courage isn't the absence of fear or doubt. It's the ability to act in spite of them. You know, we have a lot of death and violence at home, and I wrote a blog recently, you know, a while ago that, you know, they talked about how any coward can hide behind a mask and a gun, but it takes courage to settle differences through words and understanding.
Yeah.
So that's the message that I want to send out to everybody at home or whoever is listening, that as long as you breathe, there's hope. And, you know, my coach told me one time that, and I know it's a quote from a president, to whom much is given, much is required. As children of God, we have certain standards that must be met. If God gives you a talent or a skill or a knowledge base and you don't use it appropriately, I believe that you do God a disservice, and you do yourself and your friends and your family a disservice if you don't use the skills that he's given you to make a difference in the lives of others. So then we go through this whole process of, you know, I just want to encourage people to not impede the progress of another. We're all running the same race, so it doesn't make sense to have this whole crabs in a barrel syndrome.
Yeah.
We all need to stand up, take your place. Young men, do what you're supposed to do. If you have a kid, take care of your kid. Young ladies, you know, live your life. Don't believe everything these boys tell you because sometimes they really and truly don't care.
Right.
You have to understand the difference and, you know, pray for a spirit of love, a spirit of prophecy, discernment, knowledge, and wisdom. So, and that's what I want to impart on people because I know when God calls my number, I really want to hear, well done, my good and faithful servant, well done.
Thank you so much for that, Charles. As we come to the end of the program, I want to let listeners know that all your website and book and contact information will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com. I want to thank you so much for being on the program and sharing from your experience and hope. It's been a wonderful conversation. I can say well done right now.
Thanks so much,
Kate. And listeners, before we close the program, I want to share a tip for your spiritual tool belt you wrap around yourself each day. Just a little thought on fear. When I was a child and teen, this world was my natural home and the universe my stomping ground. I dreamed without limit and my dreams caught fire. As a young adult, I thought I could do anything, and I usually did. I was something nearly or seemingly indestructible, so I thought, no fear, perhaps a touch of stupidity, but no fear. I began to know fear much later when I fell in love and got close to the person I would share my life with. That is, when I had something to lose, a life built together, a home, our dreams, and the little ones who would join us. Suddenly, the fluid, whimsical nature of the universe I loved for so long became, in my mind, precarious and random. For some time, I feared the random. It's just so easy to emerge from the web of life and be absorbed right back into it through circumstances beyond our control. I looked up the word fear. The Merriam-Webster definition of fear is an unpleasant, often strong emotion caused by anticipation or awareness of danger. But I also looked up the origin of the word, and I've always loved to study the origins of words. And one of the origins of the word fear comes from the Latin to attempt. And it was that definition that caught me, the word fear being related to the word attempt. So perhaps fear is not only an awareness of danger. It resonated with me that when we fear, when we attempt to live or to love or to dream or to act on dreams. Somehow I found that comforting. It helped me to put fear in its place. And love is strength. After some years, I learned to live in love, to trust with the faith of a grown-up. that life is merciful, that we are eternally safe, that no matter what scars might befall our hearts, all would be well. Nothing is lost in this universe. So live, and when you experience fear, feel it, respect it, and try to move beyond to do what you can, when you can, to keep those dreams burning. Make your attempts and make a journey for your soul. Don't wait for every detail to be nailed down. Meet your miracles halfway. Thank you for listening to the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. Our guest was Charles Thomas Jr. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems right here at PRN.FM every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.